You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Randall Snyder. Randall, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Good evening, everyone. It's great to be here. It's a dream come true.
Hey, Randall.
How you guys been?
Coming on board.
We've been good.
Pretty good, buddy.
Yeah, we've been good. Man? It's been a while, right?
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Randall, you and I, we haven't talked in, what, 3 weeks? Like, it's good to have you back on the show, man.
You guys are really selling this, by the way. This is totally believable.
So, Randall is a loyal listener of the SGU, and we brought him on because we want to talk about his experience in the Mormon Church. Now, we're going to talk about that after Rebecca tells us about this day in skepticism, but just to start a little bit, were you in LDS? Is that the version of the church that you were in?
Yeah, I only had one wife.
Is that what that means?
FLDS means Fundamentalists, Latter-day Saints, and they are an offshoot of the main one in Salt Lake City, and they never accepted polygamy being abandoned back in 1890 and 1905. So they're the ones that live on those secluded communities.
Mm-hmm. Big
Warren
love
Jeffs
and all that.
Was there?
Yeah,
right.
Leader,
so that's the ones where they kick off all the young men, so that the old guys can have the 13- and 14-year-old girls to marry.
Mm-hmm.
Not what I was associated mm-hmm. with. I was the mainstream one.
Right. Well, Rebecca, tell us first about Louis Pasteur.
Well, way to ruin the surprise, Steve.
I'm sorry.
But, yes, on July 6th, 1885, Louis Pasteur successfully tested the first rabies vaccine. Did it on a little boy who had taunted a rabid dog, was bitten by the dog, and was thereby in danger of dying a truly horrible death. Pasteur had previously worked out that he might be able to prevent rabies from, you know, taking hold using a weakened rabies virus, but that he had weakened in rabbits, but he had tested it only on dogs prior to this. So at this point, he tested on his first human, Joseph Meester, who lived. So he saved his life.
Much like Brad Pitt on World War Z.
No, not yet. Not ready.
That was pretty good, Randall.
It was a good attempt. We're not quite there yet, but yes.
We'll call it a premature segue.
happens to most men at some point.
At some point, right?
Meester was 9 years old at the time. He rabies has like 100% mortality rate, and he lived to be 74. I mean, Pasteur saved his life.
He lived to be 64.
Oh, you're right, 64. I can add 64.
He became the caretaker of the Pasteur Institute, actually, and he served as caretaker until his death. He died, actually, quite tragically. He committed suicide on the occasion of the German invasion of Paris.
Hmm.
Kind of a sad end, it was kind of cool that he did live, you know, as a young kid, and he went on to care quite a bit about what Pasteur was doing.
Pasteur was uber cool. I mean, that guy, you know, his career was just unbelievably amazing. Look at all the things that he did. He, you know, he sort of broke through with the whole notion of microbes, you know, that little germs causing disease. Once you have that insight, you know, he ran with that ball really far. I mean,
he's one of the first microbiologists.
Yeah.
Didn't really exist as a discipline before him.
Hey, Steve, quick question. When something has a 100%, you know, fatality rate, so it's okay to do experimental sort of vaccinations and stuff on people, right?
Well, it's ethically easier. There's something called compassionate use. There are normal ethical rules for experimentation and for using drugs off-label, for using, you know, experimental treatments are relaxed significantly if somebody has an unavoidably terminal illness. Because it goes, you know, the rationale is, what do they got to lose? If they're willing to try some desperate experimental treatment, it's reasonable to do that if the only alternative is certain short-term death. All right, so Randall, LDS, tell us about this. Now, first of all, you do credit the SGU with saving you from the Mormon Church, right?
No, you didn't save me from the Mormon Church. You saved me from the aftermath of leaving the church. Yeah.
We eased your transition.
Welcome. I'll take it.
Absolutely.
You're welcome.
Yes. You guys were the soft, cushiony pillow that I landed on when I, you know, took the quote unquote leap of faith to leave the church, because it's a very all encompassing church to be a member of. It consumes every part of your identity. And there's a lot of social cost to leaving it, which is what makes it difficult for so many people to leave. It is like a soft cult. It's cult-like, but and the term cult there's no definitive definition that I know of out there for a cult. There's characteristics, kind of like the psychopath test, but.
Yeah, exactly. There's the demarcation problem, with a cult, in that there are features, and the more of those features you have, the more cult-like you are, but there's no one sharp demarcation line.
Right. It'd have to be arbitrarily determined, and therefore that's where it's problematic. So what happened was, I was born in the church. I grew up in Southern California, big Mormon family, one of seven kids, went on a mission. But just before I went on my mission, my older brother came out of the closet, so to speak, when he left BYU and went to Vanderbilt to get a PhD in philosophy, which is toxic to religion. And it came out that he was an atheist just before I went on my mission. And that was a really seminal moment in my life, and it was pretty traumatic. So we became estranged for several years because of that. And then when I went through my quote-unquote faith crisis, I did it without any assistance from my brother. I just wanted to do this on my own. But once I determined I didn't believe anymore, I finally called my brother up. And he's a very intelligent, very erudite individual. And he could have referred me to a million different things. And the first thing he referred me to was the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Cool.
Nice. Wow.
And the genius awesome. Behind it wasn't because he did not want to teach me what he thought I should think. He wanted to teach me how to think. He wanted to reboot my brain.
That's a good idea.
Because he knew of where I came from and the epistemology I'd used my entire life.
Hey, I like that. We're going to use that as a catchphrase now. Reboot your brain. Listen to the Ooh. SGU.
I'm going
to
patent
pay
that.
Randall,
did your brother, like, have a strong emotional reaction to this?
I smell a t-shirt.
When you called him?
Is that what that is?
Yeah, we actually talked for about 5 hours. Because, he'd been estranged from the entire family, and no one really knew how to relate to him. And no one would talk about things he was interested in. So he just kind of separated himself from the family. And then now, after I left, I understood why. I basically regained a brother, and that brother became my best friend. So,
but did you lose the rest of your family?
No, it was tough. One of my sisters did tell me when she first found out that it felt like a death in the family.
Mm-hmm.
When I left the church, that was hard. But they've all since chilled out. My mother, who could not be even in the same room as my brother when he left the church without crying, she died of cancer back in '96. So,
yeah, I'm sorry
to hear that. She would have taken it the hardest. My sisters took it hard, but they've all been really good after the fact. And my dad has been awesome all along.
Do you think that because of your older brother that it was a little bit easier? Did he blaze the trail for you a little bit?
No, actually, he acted as a cautionary tale. He probably prolonged my stay in the church.
Oh, because you saw how hard it was.
Well, I just didn't want to become an atheist. I was petrified of becoming an atheist and all the things that believers think, that when you lose faith in God, then you're just going to want to go out and rape and pillage and end up within a ditch with a needle in your arm, because you have no moral compass. And he being a cautionary tale, it was like, you have to be careful about Satan. That's one of the things that's they inculcate into the membership, is that Satan's very cunning and you got to be careful. His arguments are going to sound convincing, but you got to stay within the guidelines of the church to be safe. So as a cautionary tale, he didn't really blaze the trail, and that's probably why I didn't involve him in my process of deconversion from the Mormon Church. Because I didn't become a skeptic, a secular humanist, and an atheist all at once. It's really started with this show.
Yeah, it's a process.
Right.
Randall, I'm curious to know, do you remember like the early thoughts about questioning your religion? Like, how did that happen in your head?
I've read too many books on cognition to believe my memory anymore.
But you have a narrative. What's the narrative?
The narrative that I've confabulated. It started with, because one thing that's great about the Mormon Church, there's two things that's great about the Mormon Church. Number one, it's young, unlike Christianity. It's not hidden by the cloak of time. It's a fairly new religion. There's a ton of documentation around its origins. The other thing I like is that Joseph Smith had balls and made some really falsifiable claims that science can answer, like claiming that the Native Americans are Semitic in origin. Well, we have DNA now. And you guys actually mentioned that back when Perry was alive. You mispronounced Angel Moroni. You pronounced it Moroni. which sounds like an Italian mafia guy. And I remember Perry getting a kick out of that.
Well,
it's Moroni. It's Moroni.
Yeah, not Moroni.
Moroni.
The other time you guys mentioned Mormonism was when you had that guy from, it was a professor from Connecticut, some university in Connecticut that was an archaeologist.
Ken Fader, most likely.
He talked about the pre-Clovis sites that had shown migration across the Bering Strait was earlier than was originally thought with the Clovis sites. And then you guys asked him, well, what do you think about the claims of some people about the Semitic origins? And his answer was, and I quote, "Oh, God, no." that was hilarious. Those are the two times I can remember you mentioning Mormonism because it kind of intersected with science. I went on my mission in Phoenix, and they've got a really impressive Easter pageant. My job was to work the crowd. I was to look for people that didn't look Mormon and go up and talk to them.
They were the people who weren't wearing ties.
Mormons value conformity above all else, and so very conservative. They're stuck in the 1950s. Culture-wise. Short conservative hair, full shaved, you know, all American.
Did you get any converts?
On my mission, I had about 40 baptisms.
Wow. I mean, I want to say well done, but at the same time...
At the same time, I want to go back and call those people, but I think most of them left anyway. The church has a really poor retention rate of their converts, but it's really funny that the growth of the church is almost exclusively in third world countries. And so if you go to like South America, you'll come home with like 200 baptisms. If you go to Denmark, like my cousin, he came home with a goose egg.
Whoa. Sucks to be him, I guess. So Randall, what was it? One day you woke up and you weren't yourself anymore. You were an atheist. Like, what was that day?
Was there a moment that you can remember where you made some kind of mental transition, or it really was just imperceptibly slow?
It was pretty slow, but there are moments that you remember. It started in 2006 when I learned about Joseph Smith. And this is one of the things I wanted to talk about is the church whitewashes its history. So the members are woefully ignorant of their own history because they're only taught the whitewash version on Sunday. And the internet's caused problems with that.
Damn,
but in 2006, I learned that Joseph Smith had married 8 women that were already married to other men. And I already knew that he was a secret polygamist. I didn't know that some of them were 14 and that some of them were already married to other living men at the time. And that set me in a very private, secret spiral because I didn't want to deal with the social consequences. I didn't even tell my wife. And I let that, I lingered, and I was actually, at the time, one of the leaders of the congregation. Not the bishop, but I was... the high priest group leader, which is one of the lower leaders of the congregation. And I had a practice that had a lot of Mormon dentists referring to me. I didn't want to deal with the cost, so I suffered in silence up until fall of 2008 when Prop 8 came out. And all of a sudden, I was like, this does not resonate with my moral, internal moral compass. And that's when I decided to take my faith seriously. And that was a process of about 6 months of reading insatiably all the stuff I can get my hands on of actual Mormon history and getting angrier and angrier that I didn't know this stuff and I was 34 years old. I let my wife know and she didn't react very well at first, but she came around after 6 months. But during that 6 months, I remember sitting on the patio going, I don't think I believe in God anymore. And we were out by the pool in Phoenix. And she says, it was hard enough that you left the church, but now you're an atheist? So that was her reaction, but she's since become an atheist as well. So I've been extremely lucky.
Yeah, that could have went really bad.
It goes really bad all the time. I have many friends who are who's lost their marriage over this issue. It's very intense.
I know it's not as simple as this, but your story makes me think that it was just a necessity of having the information there. You know, your brain was being analytical. You just didn't have the information to stitch together the real story. And then once that information was in there, your intellect took over and said, look, this can't be real.
Well, even though I did have the information, it still was a process because it is a constant inculcation and indoctrination from the time, the earliest you can remember. You're just constantly reinforced that this is the one and only true church and that anything outside of it, you'll find misery. And then you know unconsciously of you know, I could lose my marriage over this. I could lose my kids. I could lose my family. My practice could suffer. And so you kind of drag your feet, or sometimes you drag your feet.
Yeah, because you could think, as you say, it's all from the devil, right? So the internet is the devil. And that solves all problems.
And the church growth has significantly dropped since 1998. Harold Bloom wrote a book called The American Religion back in like 92. And he declared at that time, because growth rates in the late 80s and early 90s were looking like that the Mormon Church was going to have 100 million members by the middle of this century and be the first world religion since Islam. Boom, the internet hits. And now the church is growing in the United States at a slower rate than the general population is growing. So they're growing relatively, or they're growing absolutely, but relative to the general population, they're contracting, if that makes sense.
Well, Randall, thanks for sharing your story with us. That we all find that really fascinating. And, you know, we're obviously happy that we played some role in your transition to a religion-free life. Let's move on to some news items. Evan, it's crop circle time of year again.
Yeah.
And there's a new twist on the whole crop circle story.
There is. But first, I have a question for Randall.
Yep.
Because you were, a 12th level high priest, did you say? Something like that?
We're not the Masons.
7th level spells or something?
Although we stole a ton of shit from the Masons for our temple ceremony. Like verbatim.
Oh, is that right?
So your question, so cool, I was a high priest. That just means that I had the highest level of priesthood that you can have. It doesn't mean that I had the highest level of authority.
So what is the official position of the Mormon Church concerning crop circles?
The Mormon Church does not take positions on anything that they don't have to. So there is no official position by the Mormon Church on crop circles. But if you're talking about the alien twist on crop circles, the Mormon God lives on a planet near a star named Kolob. So there's a little bit of sci-fi in Mormonism and alien worship.
Not exactly Scientology, but yeah.
So here's how the headline read from the Huffington Post. Crop circles are no hoax, concludes historian after studying Google Earth's new 1945 overlay. Well, this is actually an older news story. I had found an article by the Birmingham Mail from the United Kingdom in January of 2013. So the HuffPo's a few months behind on this one. I'm not sure why they're reporting on it now. Research by archaeologist, seriologist Greg Jeffries of Tasmania. And by the way, a seriologist is a person who devotes a large chunk of their time, right, studying crop circles and Special K cereal. And he has revealed evidence of the strange circles in the English countryside, which were captured in photographs dating as far back as 1945. Jeffries used Google Earth's new 1945 overlay technologies in which you can look at old aerial photos from the past of a given location. And we're kind of assuming that the photos are properly placed into the correct location. I'm not really sure how they verify that. They must have a means of doing that. We'll take Google at their word for that. But Jeffries spent more than 300 hours scouring the English countryside using the technology, and he found a large number of things that he is describing as crop circles.
Well, they are circles in crops.
Definitely. They definitely are.
Well, there was the issue of the anomalies in the images themselves that he had to weed out. So there's a chance that this could just be artifacts of the image, the age of the image or the imaging technique.
Yeah.
Photographs can be altered by the ravages of time and elements, right? Causing images to become compromised. Little marks, dust, watermarks, similar physical subjections must be accounted for. Here's what Jeffrey says, the history guy. This discovery proves that claims by various artists are to be the sole creators of crop circles are themselves a hoax. It just goes to show that the circles remain unexplained.
Name that logical fallacy.
Straw man.
Well, I would say it's a non sequitur. I don't know that it's really a straw man. There may be a bit of a hasty generalization in there as well, which the seriologists do that a lot, as do a lot of pseudoscientists. Like they take one example and they say, see, this example has this feature, which destroys all of the claims by skeptics that none of them have this feature. When they're looking at multiple different phenomena, for example, if we look at these photographs, there's 11 of them connected to the article, that we're looking at here of alleged crop circles from these 1945 overlays. Some of them look like photographic artifacts. Again, they're all, you think there's one triangle.
Yeah.
The rest
that's
are
right.
All just circles.
Or ovals. There's a couple ovals.
Which actually is an interesting point because some of them look like the picture itself may not be exactly vertical, but the circle is, and therefore that suggests it's more of a photographic artifact. There's also no shattering or anything to suggest that it has three dimensionality. Mm-hmm. Other ones, however, you see like the rim shadow that matches the shadow of the trees, and those are probably actually physically in the crops. But then he says, like, for example, There's no lines, no tram lines or footprint lines to show how somebody could have had access to the circle. Mm. It's like, first of all, you don't need to have that. You know, you could walk through the crops without leaving a noticeable trace. Some of them do have access lines. You know, they are across tram lines or whatever, and others are probably just photographic artifacts. But you don't see, what he didn't find a single picture of, is anything that looks anything even remotely like the more contemporary crop circles, where there's any complexity to it. These are just circles and rings, or, you know, either photographic artifacts or just simple things. You know, if you piled something up in a field into a rough circle and then it left a patch behind, you know, that could explain some of these circles.
Correct.
For example. So not compelling evidence at all. The fallacy is in arguing that this means that the modern crop circle phenomenon was not sparked by Doug and Dave, who started the modern hoaxing of crop circles. That's the logical fallacy that he's committing. It's just a non sequitur. It does not follow that argument.
Now, they think this is a cover-up? Like, what's the impetus here to hide the alien visitation thing? Is this a government deal?
No, I don't think he was going there, Jay. He's got a quote that kind of rubbed me the wrong way that I think might help answer your question. He said, "Further, I believe that if the mainstream scientific community were not so timid and so conservative in their view of the universe, that they would not be sitting on their hands pretending this thing is not happening, but would be seriously investigating this unexplained phenomenon." I mean, come on. The mainstream scientific community, timid and conservative. I mean, this is the yep. community that brought us quantum entanglement, magnetars, black holes, superposition. If the evidence is there, they will go to it.
Bob, that sentence proves that this guy has no clue how science works.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the people that are interested in science and in conducting science. I mean, I would love nothing more than to have some type of proof that these things exist. You know, if aliens, as scary as it would be, I would be slightly horrified, I think, too. I mean, imagine that. But even still, how provocative could you possibly get?
It wouldn't be that scary, Jay. I mean, if they've been making crop circles for half a century, I mean, how belligerent could they be, right?
No, Bob, you know, the scary part would be if they were making crop circles for half a century, what the hell's wrong with them? You know, why don't you come talk to us?
Bob, crop circles are just instructions for the invasion fleet.
Oh, must be.
M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah. Thank you.
How could I miss that?
God, talk about horrible writing. Maybe we should review that train wreck of a movie.
We'll get there. Shyamalama Ding Dong, that's definitely one of the worst ones.
I had consulted some farmers about some possible alternative explanations for what the circles are. Steve, you mentioned the crops and stuff. So they also mentioned, you know, if you put an animal, you tie it to a stake, it's going to walk around in a circle, right? And kind of wear out that grass. You know, you stack up some seed or hay or an old silo that they tore down. The farmers, they mentioned many, many very plausible reasons as to why these circles, if they're even real circles, could happen, yet, you know, this archaeologist failed to acknowledge any of those. So, thanks to Dave Caswell, Rich Luig, David Arundel, and Nathaniel Stone for helping me out with some feedback on that.
All right, thanks, Evan. I'm going to go on to another news item. This one is really cool. This is a recent study looking at the neurology of morality. To back up a little bit, one of the main sort of skeptical lessons in terms of studying how the brain works is that we all construct our image of reality. Everything that we think we see and remember is a constructed narrative that is highly biased and filtered and flawed. And the same thing is true of our moral feelings. You know, there's nothing objective about our moral feelings. We evolved to undergo a certain subconscious moral calculus that makes us feel a certain way. A sense of justice, for example, exists for an evolutionary reason. Another example of this sort of constructed reality is the notion of agency, or you can also call this the theory of mind. So that is the notion that other entities have a mind, and that therefore that they have feelings and ideas and thoughts and plans of their own. So the fact that I know that you are another person with your own thoughts and ideas and feelings is, you know, because there's part of my brain which creates that sense that you have agency. You have your own mind. Yeah. Hmm. Now, our brains will, again, undergo a subconscious calculus and decides what things out there in the environment likely have agency. And it's not based upon a scientific or rational understanding of how things actually work. It's just based upon a simple set of rules about how things are behaving. One of the primary rules is that something which is moving in a non-inertial frame is presumed to be an agent, to have agency. If it looks as if it's moving under its own power somehow.
Like not a projectile or something.
Yeah, it's not just something that's falling or just rolling. It's something that looks like it's moving under its own power, a non-inertial frame. Then our brain immediately slots that as something that probably has agency. It's something that's acting on its own. We've talked about this sort of thing, you know, before. If you hear the bushes rustling, you're likely to assume it's a tiger rather than the wind. Or, mm-hmm. you know, we evolved, you know, from those cavemen who jumped to the conclusion that it was probably a tiger, because the ones that went to investigate probably got eaten, at least more often.
It's also the reason why those iPets sold so well.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. You know, stuffed animals, cartoons, we imbue emotions and agency to these things because they're acting as if they're alive. The fact that they are two-dimensional or that they can't possibly be alive doesn't affect how we feel about it. It may affect how we think about it, but we feel about it as if it has agency. There's a cool experiment. I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, where psychologists took it's two-dimensional animation. It's like a little room, and there's a big triangle, a little triangle, and a big square. And they're moving around on the two-dimensional screen. And they're moving in a non-inertial frame. They're moving as if they have agency. And, you know, subjects were asked to construct a story about what they're doing. And if you watch it, you guys got to watch this video. We'll link to it in the show notes. You construct this whole narrative around these two-dimensional regular shapes. It's like, oh yeah, the big square is the daddy and he's being really mean. He's abusing the mommy. And then the little triangle is the baby and he's running away and hiding. You know, it's like you have no problem constructing an elaborate emotional narrative around shapes just by the moving simply on the screen. In this new study, what they did was they looked at the relationship between how our brain assigns agency to things and how we feel about them morally. And what they found, they did two basic experiments. They exposed people to things that traditionally we do not assign agency to. One was a corpse and another was a robot.
Zombie!
Was like a robot, something that was not animate, right? So it wasn't animate or moving in a way that you would think to imbue the sense of agency. And then the object was the target of abuse. What happened was that seeing the object that was inanimate, the focus of moral abuse caused people to imbue it with a certain amount of agency, meaning to think about it as if it had feelings or a mind.
Steve, does it have to be something that has to meet a certain threshold of being close to having agency? Like a robot looks like a human, a corpse was a human.
Yeah,
if you're abusing a rock, you're not going to endow it with agency and feel empathy towards the rock.
Yeah, that's a good question. They didn't do enough follow-up experiments to find out where that line was.
Because I wonder if like a tree, like a lot of people, yeah. You know, if you start beating up a tree, they might endow it with agency.
This actually occurred on the most recent episode of the comedy Bang Bang TV show. If anybody's watching that, they just had the first episode of season 2, and there's an entire joke around a tiny ladder that Scott Aukerman needs to throw into a furnace, and he can't do it because it's adorable and it's like cooing at him. And it continues through the entire show. And you actually I can identify very easily with inanimate objects. I don't know, but I was definitely feeling very sorry for the poor little ladder. It was the subject of both physical and psychological torment, and both were equally painful to watch. And it was literally, it was a stepladder. So it was a pretty funny example of what you guys are talking about.
Yeah. So the researchers concluded that because you can only behave immorally towards something that has a mind, that if somebody is behaving immorally towards something, that therefore it must have a mind, right? So we assign agency to something because it is the target of an immoral act or immoral behavior. The other end of the spectrum, they looked at, you know, exposed subjects to images of people, you know, so people who obviously we assign agency to, who are also being victimized, who are being the target of abuse. And what happens is people tend to assign them less agency or less mind, which is interesting because, and the hypothesis there was that, perhaps it causes mental anguish to see somebody that we know as a fully feeling human be who is suffering under abuse, and therefore we downgrade their humanity. We dehumanize them in order to relieve our anguish or our cognitive dissonance over the pain. So, and we know this from other experiments, right? That, you know, we tend to dehumanize outgroups, for example. And so the threshold for causing them harm goes down. You know, we have the ability to kill other people, even, you know, a non-psychopathic, you know, average person can bring themselves to kill somebody else under the right circumstances. What are those circumstances? One in which the other person is dehumanized, and the one of the biggest ways in which we do that is to view them as a member of an outgroup.
Actually, there was another really interesting study that just came out that was about that very thing. So there was a group of psychologists that did a study where they gathered a group of white people and had them watch video clips of a needle touching someone's skin. And they showed images of the needle touching white skin and touching black skin, and they measured their reactions using skin conductance and whatever. And what they found was that viewers who saw white people receiving a painful stimulus responded a lot more dramatically than when they saw black people receiving the same stimulus. The thinking is exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
They're othering black people, and it's it's not an outward racist reaction. It's something that's been completely and utterly internalized, that they've, you know, othered this entire group of people.
One tragic area in society where this manifests itself in America is the war on drugs. And there was a recent book that came out that showed that black individuals that are almost always placed in front of a white judge suffer, I can't remember the number, but it was almost like 20 to 30 times more severe punishments than white people with the exact same drug offense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one other wrinkle about this, this does also foreshadow the upcoming segment. We're going to review the movie World War Z, which is about zombies, of course. But you guys ever hear like this unwritten rule about science fiction that the good guys or the heroes essentially have unlimited ability with abandon, they can kill an unlimited number of certain kinds of things without there being any moral judgment against them?
I read that unwritten rule, yeah.
Yeah, it's robots, insects, undead, monsters, and Nazis.
Yeah, that Nazis. Yeah, you definitely. They are the all-time villain. Yep.
Yeah, robots as you want, but not people. You know, right? So, but
what about Nazi zombies?
Well, there was actually a movie where there were Nazi zombies. That was Sucker Punch. Sucker Punch.
Wait,
what? Yeah, awesome.
No, that's Sucker Punch.
Cyborg Nazi.
Red Snow.
Yeah, Sucker Punch had.
Red Snow, yes.
Sucker Punch also had zombie Nazis.
Get that shit out of here, Sucker Punch. Go watch Red Snow. It's one of the greatest zombie movies ever.
But I think that Nazis...
Is it really? I've got to see
Nazis,
that.
Nazis is a stand-in for a generic enemy soldier. I think we tend to portray enemy soldiers as a uniform, as, you know, as literally as uniform. So think about stormtroopers from Star Wars. They weren't people. Right. They were just the outfits.
Right. I wasn't even sure the first time I watched Star Wars that those were people. I thought they were like droids.
They certainly weren't.
I mean, I was like 7 at the time, but
yeah, they're not individuals. They're drones. They're just enemy soldier drones. So I think that's again so that we can enjoy the hero killing hundreds or thousands of these things without the moral pain of thinking that they're killing things who have agency.
Right. A father, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh my gosh, you know, you just killed someone who had 10 children.
Which is why, you know, like more contemporary movies where the enemies are humanized can be so poignant. It's so different than the more jingoistic, you know, classic movies where the enemies are always anonymous.
It's also why movies like District 9 are so powerful, because they take that traditionally othered species that looks like a giant bug that you could just squish and turns it into something that has emotions and feelings.
Exactly.
Prawns.
Or think about classic Indian cowboy and Indian movies where the Indians are essentially dehumanized and anonymized as well. Mm-hmm. Just enemy drones to be mowed down. Interesting. So yeah, they, you know, I find this kind of research fascinating. You know, looking at how our brains construct how we think about things, and morality is just one of those things that our brains absolutely construct based upon evolved rules. And then people get very self-righteous about it, you know, about what their evolved moral sense. Now, I know all you guys saw World War Z.
Yep.
Yeah,
you owe me $10.
14 for me. I saw it in 3D.
I fell asleep 3 times.
I did take my 5 and 7-year-old, and the 5-year-old had a blanket to cover his head. And he only covered his head a couple of times, and then he stood up after it was over and said, "That wasn't that scary."
I'm judging you as a parent right now. That movie is not for 5 and 7-year-olds. That said, I did not hate World War Z. I liked it.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good movie.
I found it unsatisfying.
There were certain parts of it that were satisfying. So I'll tell you what I liked about it. I actually liked the fast zombies just because it was different. They were freaking scary. You know, they're running through the streets of Philadelphia in a total panic.
By the way, there are going to be spoilers. If you don't want to hear spoilers, skip ahead.
People were just running in a panic. They weren't even sure what they were running from. And the zombies were just leaping on people just to bite them. I mean, they were fast, motivated, and psychotic. I mean, they would do whatever it took to get their teeth into you. And the virus spread in literally 12 seconds. So it really, the infection just was a wave moving across the city.
It was
one of those horror movies where you're thinking, if I were in that situation right now, I probably wouldn't survive. I would die.
I would have been dead. We all would have been dead unless we were married to Brad Pitt or
I had one of those moments where I'm in the theater and I'm like, all right, if that shit started like in the upper right hand corner, like where are my exit points? Like where am I going? Like you do a spot check real quick. I liked the movie too. I did like it. I felt like they were building to an ending that never came though.
Yeah, I got that feeling as well.
Don't you think they left it open on purpose? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Are they going to be doing more? Because I walked away assuming that was what was happening there.
Yeah, I think they definitely left it open on purpose. A couple things I couldn't get past. I mean, I enjoyed it. Some of the major set pieces were really, really effective. The Philadelphia takeover that Steve was talking about was really good. The takeover of Israel.
Breaching the wall in Israel.
The fall of Jerusalem was a whole great scene.
That was a great scene. The plane sequence was really cool. But a couple things I couldn't get past is, first off, I mean, I know the book. I've listened to it on audio many times. Just absolutely love it. And I just couldn't get past the fact that they destroyed that book. I mean, it's not the book. It's not even, you could almost barely say it was inspired because there's really no connection between the book and the movie. The other thing was that a big zombie movie like that really needs to be R. PG-13, give me a break. We need gore. It should be zombies eviscerating people. And they didn't even eat people. They just pretty much just wanted to bite them.
Right. Well, now we have to define, like, what's a zombie? And this is an interesting topic because I actually get into damn near fist fights with people over this. I have a traditional sense of a shambling, slow-moving zombie where the real danger is when there's too many of them. As an example, the Walking Dead TV show illustrates that very well. Like, the thing that you really only should be afraid of is when there's a huge number of them. Any single person should be able to take out one or two zombies. So now we're in like Olympic athlete zombie level.
Beyond
here.
Olympic. Like, they were jumping 10 feet in the air and grabbing onto helicopters.
Oh, yeah.
Superhumans.
I'm just wondering how a pathogen can make the ligaments and the muscles, pretty much supernatural. They could jump higher than any NBA player. They could run as fast as an Olympic sprinter.
That was a point that was addressed in the book. I agree with Bob. This movie was not the book. I kind of knew that going in, right, Bob? Didn't we know that?
And we knew it. It still doesn't bother me.
You got to get over that. Movies are movies. Books are books. Yeah. It's a different medium. You can't judge a movie by how closely it skews to the book. Just look at it unto itself. Same thing with the fast versus slow zombies, Jay. This was a movie about fast zombies. Who cares that they weren't slow zombies? That's a different. It's almost a different genre. So. What Max Brooks writes, which I think is reasonable, is that it's not that they have preternatural strength. It's just that they don't feel pain. They don't care. So they will give 100% of their mechanical effort without anything to inhibit them. And
like
that
meth
actually
addicts.
Makes sense. Yeah. That
not
makes
caring
sense.
Caring can't make you jump 10 feet though.
Well, I don't remember seeing in the movie any person jumping farther than you could mechanically jump with muscles and bones and ligaments.
There was a scene when he first escaped on the first helicopter, a zombie on the roof jumped. It may not have been 10 feet, but it was like 7 or 8 feet in the air. I mean, they would have been dunking with their nuts.
Also, Steve, the wall climbing feat in Jerusalem, I mean, you know, that would never take place with normal people.
Well, no, I think is something that is explained by the whole, you know, shutting down your pain sensors. Like, yeah, you can build a human pyramid out of bodies, and that's basically what was happening there. I don't think there's
anything superhuman
about that.
No, that was way too tall, though, Rebecca. It was like, you know, there was a 50-foot wall.
It was a pile of people.
They just had a lot of bodies.
Yeah,
they had a lot of people.
That's part of the terrifying aspect of this, right? Okay, so there's a million of these things outside the wall. They can do things like this.
What about adrenaline? What about adrenaline, Steve? Could that explain it if they were just totally pumped with adrenaline? I mean, you could do amazing things under the influence of adrenaline.
Yeah, so let's assume that whatever the virus was doing to the body, it was functioning at maximum biological capacity, physical capacity, without any. And you know, and even like Max Brooks wrote in the book, like they will use muscles, they will do things, they will do feats of strength that will rip the muscles apart, and they don't care.
And as luck should have it, all of the zombies were very fit. I don't know if you guys noticed, but there was not a single fat zombie.
Very slender, right? Yeah, good point.
I assume that they were left for food somewhere. But
right.
Yeah. My main problem with the science of it is at one point they say that airplanes were the most important vector sort of to transmitting this disease or whatever it is, from country to country. But the longest we've heard of the disease taking hold in someone is 10 minutes. Like mm-hmm. in Korea, they say, yeah, it took this guy 10 minutes to turn. That's the longest. So that makes no sense. Nobody was getting bitten 10 minutes before they got on an airplane and then got on the airplane and then turned into a zombie, destroyed everyone or like bit everyone.
Got to check out customs, right, in the other
right.
end of the leg.
Like that,
yeah, the virus
happen.
Makes a plane crash because they'll eat
basically.
The pilots.
Right, yeah. So like that did not make sense to me. And
you're right, that's a plot hole. I don't think they were thinking about that. Normally,
what about a boat?
Normally, planes would be the most important vector, like for spreading the flu or something like that.
Right.
But with a 12-second incubation period, which is implausible. I mean, you want to talk about implausible? That's implausible.
Even the 10 minutes,
right.
You know, will
even
grant
the 10
them
minutes,
at the
right.
early.
That actually has an interesting tie-in with viruses and infections themselves, because they're always a balance. Because when you get an infection like that, you don't want to be too powerful, because if you're too all-encompassing and if you just take out your host, then you're not going to spread and you're going to burn out. So this is what would have happened. This would have burned out in a very isolated way. It's the diseases that can linger for a little while and let you transfer it and transmit it to other people. Those are the ones that could really be nasty, because they could spread really far and you won't even know you have it. So,
like Planet of the Apes, for instance. Planet of the Apes, spoiler alert for Planet of the Apes, the most recent film. At the end of that, that's how this virus spreads, that is, you know, assumed to be the thing that takes out all of humanity. But that's because, you know, the guy sneezes a bit weird and doesn't think much of it and gets on a plane. Like that, so it takes long enough, it's mild enough symptoms.
You're right. And in the Max Brooks book version, the incubation period was a day or a couple of days.
Ah.
A day, really?
Yeah. And that was actually a scary part of that spread, because you would have these safe havens, but there was somebody in there who was breeding the virus and they were going to turn overnight when nobody was paying attention, or like on a plane. You know, that could happen. But I understand why they did the 12-second thing, because then you get that wave of zombification, you know, flowing over a city, and that's cool. But I think they needed to explain how it could spread otherwise. It would imagine how scary it would have been if like 8 out of 10 people turned in 12 seconds, but one or two people took a few hours or a day to turn for whatever reason. And those are the people who are really spreading it. And those are the Typhoid Marys.
And I actually thought that that's where it was going, but it never got there. Like when they were in Korea and they were like, oh yeah, it took that guy 10 minutes to turn. That my first thought was like, oh, okay. So some people react differently to this and they're going to explore that. And then, no, of course not, because the doctor shot himself in the head, which was hilarious, by the way.
Oh, my God.
I loved it.
Joke.
Did you guys like, you know, that the world's leading neurologist that they had that ended up shooting himself in the head? Did you like his anthropomorphizing of Mother Nature as a bitch, psychopathic serial killer?
Yeah.
That was,
you know, it was funny, and it's the kind of thing that nerdy scientists do.
Yeah, especially like a two young nerdy scientists thrown into a situation like this. I think it made sense for his character.
Trying to be poetic. Yeah, it made sense.
I knew once he said that he was going to be dead within the next 10
minutes. Yeah, I know. That was definitely, as soon as he said that, it's like I see the red shirt forming on him.
It's a very Jurassic Park sort of thing to say before you get eaten.
You know, I was thinking about his tone and his comments, and I don't mind the scientist guy in the movie, like, you know, he was one of the people that represented science. Don't mind him being passionate and poetic about things, but I always think in the back of my head, is that what people think? You know, is that what people think scientists are saying and doing, or what is that becoming like a cliche thing about how to handle a scientist, you know? Like Jurassic Park, perfect example, Rebecca.
The rock star scientist.
I don't think it was a negative portrayal of a scientist, you know, and the guys, the WHO guys at the end were, I think, like perfect scientists because they were all like really nerdy and they didn't really do much physically speaking, you know, but they solved problems. And I liked the end idea, even though it made no sense to me. So that was the other sciencey thing that I had a problem with, which is, okay, so again, spoiler, the way that they're going to combat the zombies is to disappear, and they can develop this. Well, Brad Pitt discovers
camouflage.
That zombies, don't attack people who are going
terminally
to die
Ill.
Anyway. Yeah. Terminally ill.
I thought
Ill.
That was a stretch.
And
so
he's like, if I just jab myself with a terminal illness that we can cure, then everything will be fine. So he does that, and it works, and then they cure him. They don't say what the disease is.
Yeah, Rebecca, they don't make that clear. And I'm sorry, but at that point in the movie, it seemed a little rushed. And I also felt like Brad Pitt's character got to that conclusion without earning it in the movie. It just seemed a little bit like maybe things were edited out.
Yeah, Brad Pitt walks through the zombies with his unnamed terminal illness. And then he gets back to the researchers who cure him. And then he and badass Israeli soldier lady, walk out of the WHO building very calmly as though they have nothing to fear. But Brad Pitt has been cured of the terminal illness. So wouldn't that make him visible again to the zombies? And wouldn't they be worried? Adam, my boyfriend, was arguing that there was a time jump and that the military had already cleared out all the zombies in that area. And that's why they left the building confidently.
Well, okay.
I didn't pick up on any.
You could write anything you want in your head and to explain it away, but all it takes is literally a line in a movie.
This specific thing is important though, because does it mean that the zombies won't attack you if you had a terminal illness that has now been cured? Or do you actually have to have the terminal illness at the time?
Right. I agree.
And then they create a vaccine. This is all done in very quickly in news report style. They create a vaccine. What would that vaccine look like? It doesn't make sense. If the zombies are only going after somebody who is carrying a terminal illness, and, you know, the best explanation I could come up with is like, oh, well, we'll introduce a weakened version of a terminal illness and the zombies will sense that. If that's the case, no zombie would have attacked anyone who had had a polio vaccine.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. They didn't really explore that well enough to make it make sense. Even the premise is a little bit of a stretch because, like, you see, and part of the evidence that gets Brad Pitt to this conclusion is watching like a river of zombies, as he put it, flowing over this one person who was sick. It's like they're that attuned that they it's like the person's invisible to the zombies, that they can sense as they're running past somebody that they have a terminal illness.
Yeah, even more than that, Steve. I mean, these are people that are engulfed in this viral rage. They are pretty much dead, although they didn't really need to be dead, you know, which to me is a hallmark of a zombie. If you're not dead, you know, you're not really a zombie, and they didn't even need to be dead. But how? Mm. I mean, how could they possibly sense in a fraction of a second? Oh, you're terminal. Oh, you're terminal. And avoid them. They would just sweep over everybody and anybody in their rage, and they wouldn't have time to determine if somebody's terminal. That's ridiculous. But yeah, it's an interesting idea.
It didn't seem consistent really with their behavior, because they didn't really stalk their prey or anything. There was just a mad dash and literally a leap at the closest victim and a bite. So it didn't really seem to fit with their behavior.
Even as a river of zombies would, fly across someone who they didn't want to kill, would they be so courteous as to scoot around them every time when they just beat them over?
Right. I thought of that as well. There were a couple shoulder bumps.
Knock them over, at least.
Yeah, and it also, I mean, I don't know if they're going to have a follow-up movie and how they're going to play it, but it would have made sense as, like, you have to be febrile. You have to have an acute illness and be shedding virus, you know, in order for the zombies to ignore you, which kind of makes it challenging to keep somebody in that state.
Right.
You know, and so it's not like you get a vaccine now you're invisible to zombies forever. That doesn't make any sense. So it'd be you know, a little bit more challenging. It'd be a tool that could be used in the follow-up, winning the war against the zombies, but not just a, you know, you're vaccinated and you're invisible.
I do like Brad Pitt a lot. I've always enjoyed him. He's very charismatic, and there's something charming and funny about him. And I thought for the most part this role was okay, but Brad Pitt comes across pretty flat. He's always like the too cool. He's always too cool and too good looking for his own good, right? He doesn't really act as much as he's just a movie star. You know,
it would have been powerful if he lost his shit in one scene.
Exactly. Why didn't the director talk to Brad Pitt and say, "I need you to completely lose it and either cry about your family, show fear about the zombies, like, you know, be afraid." But Brad Pitt kept his cool.
He was Batman.
Right. Yeah, he was. Yeah.
The world is ending. Hello, millions of people are dying. There's got to have some emotional toll, and he showed none of that.
And ultimately at the end, and this is the last gesture of the movie, you know, it was like watching an ice skater jump up in the air and they never land. You know, it just all of a sudden just kind of goes off into outer space. Like, I needed the landing. I needed to see them come back, and I needed to see humanity, like, fight a real battle with the zombies and get the leg up on them. And what they did, like, Rebecca described it as, like, the news.
Big long montage, yeah.
Yeah, they did, like, a quickie montage, you know, blah, 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 did this, and then blah, 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 and this. It's like, no.
That was the best part of the book. The best part of the book version of this, of World War Z, was that the Battle of Yonkers at the beginning, when the zombies pouring out of New York City decimate the army, they destroy the army because the army had no idea what they were doing. And then at the end of the book, you have another massive confrontation between the army and a very large zombie army. But this time the army is well equipped and they know what they're doing, and it's a completely different situation. And you see the full arc, the full learning curve of how to fight zombies. And we, they sort of gave you that quickie at the end, and they didn't really, I agree. They kind of leave you like, oh, this is the stuff I've been waiting for. Show me more of this. But I also was left with the impression like that was a teaser for the next movie, but we'll see.
Well, wait. Yeah. So screw that, because you can't wreck movie one because of the maybe movie two might be coming.
Yeah, I agree.
So science wise, how many Prometheuses do we give this?
What's our scale?
I don't remember what the scale is.
The scale is one to five.
Five being the worst?
Five being Prometheus.
Prometheus, the movie.
I would give it two.
Yeah.
What?
Two.
That's pretty generous.
So we gave two to Oblivion. We actually,
this is just based on the science, though, right?
Yeah, not based on the science. Yeah. We forgot to rate Star Trek Into Darkness. I think I would give that a three.
Yeah.
Oblivion's a two, Star Trek's a three, Prometheus is a five. I would give this a two.
Yeah, I'd
give it a three.
Yeah.
No, I give it a three.
Yeah.
Randall?
Two and a half.
It doesn't really matter because I haven't rated the previous ones.
So there's no calibration?
There's no calibration, so my arbitrary number is 2.5. I did want to say something about the Jews. This is for Evan.
Yep.
They spend a lot of time developing the story of the Jews and Israel. You know, they didn't think they'd go to the concentration camps in the 30s.
Oh, yeah.
6 million die. They didn't think the Arabs would attack them in 73, and they almost drove them into the sea. And finally, the Jews are vigilant enough to avoid the outside world from obliterating them, and they build their walls, and they win. And they still suffer genocide by zombie.
That's right.
Don't give them a break.
So what's...
The Jews never
because,
win. That's the...
Because they weren't watching their walls.
Yeah,
I mean,
they built all those walls
stupid.
And they didn't have eyes on the wall.
They had helicopters all over the place. What, they missed that? I mean, I don't... It was a bit contrived.
It was a bit contrived.
By the way, I would have probably given this a 3.5. I'll give it a 3 because the moon stayed together in one piece.
The moon was in one piece.
It didn't break up.
They had one pandemic cliche of the scientist infecting himself in the lab, handling a very dangerous pathogen.
Yeah, I agree. They mentioned that. It's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this infectious disease doctor handling an unknown pathogen accidentally cuts himself.
Or a centrifuge breaks and blood sprays everywhere.
So, Evan, you're going to do one more Who's That Noisy, and then on next week's show, you're going to get us all cut up.
Absolutely. I promise that I will do that. But here's the brand new, fresh off the presses, Who's That Noisy. I enjoy this one a lot. I found this one myself, and I'm very happy that I did.
Happy.
So, I think you'll enjoy it, too. Here we go.
Happy.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and uranium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, rutetium, vanadium, and anthium, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and golden, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Awesome.
That's Dr. Ataz.
good reference. So, you know. That one's all voice. You got to recognize the voice on that one. It's the only way to get it. The email to send your answers to is WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and our forums are SGUforums.com or .org.
All right. Thanks, Evan. One quick follow-up to last week, and then we're going to go on to science or fiction. Jay, you were talking about the podcast patent and reading about it further, and there was a lot of people pointed us to the Planet Money segment covering the podcasting patent troll. So I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. The patent is actually one that was filed for in 2009 and issued in 2012. And that patent itself does essentially describe modern podcasting. But of course, this was years after podcasting was well established. Now, but the patent troll is using as his precedent the fact that in 1996, he developed this service in which he, if you liked a certain magazine, for example, then you can subscribe to that magazine, and then you would be mailed cassette tapes with somebody reading the articles from the magazine. And he's saying that was the germ of an idea for podcasting. Podcasting came out of mailing cassettes of people reading magazine articles.
Sounds legit. Makes sense.
Oh boy.
Totally ridiculous.
Let's just cut him a check right now.
Yeah. We owe this guy money for podcasting.
So there's no real threat, is what we're saying.
I don't think so. I really don't think there is. After reading that, I'm like, wow, that really? Mailing cassettes? That's the basis? But it also shows what a total jackass this guy is to try to, you know, rape money from people who are doing real work because of that precedent. Ridiculous.
Of course. Anyway. Well, it's all about money, Steve.
Yeah, of course. All right, let's move on to science fiction.
Yeah.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week and 4 items. The theme is cheetahs.
Oh.
Okay. Here we go.
Cheetahs never win.
I like cheetahs.
Item number 1, the cheetah genus Acinonyx is the oldest of the extant big cats, dating back about 11 million years. Item number 2, cheetahs make several vocalizations, including a warning roar that is often mistaken for that of a lion, which they use to scare larger predators from their kills. Item number three, a recent study using GPS-enabled tracking collars clocked cheetah hunting speeds at up to 58 miles per hour, or 93 kilometers per hour. And item number four, the name cheetah comes from an Indian word meaning spotted one. Randall, as our guest this week, you get to go first.
Well, how the hell can I GWB?
They'll have to GWR.
I know, GWR is the better bet this year, apparently.
Yeah. Actually, somebody just sent
Jay.
Us.
Jay and Rebecca are tied.
The half-year stats, yeah.
What was her name?
I think Hel just froze over.
Bob, I think she confuses me and you.
No, I'm
it's
doing
really
crappy
the only
year,
explanation,
Jay.
Isn't it? What's her name? Oh, Laura Polterak sent us in science or fiction statistics, and according to her stats for this year, since January 1st, Jay is tied with me for the lead at 67%. Followed by Bob at 55, Steve at 50, and Evan at 48.
And the dice got 50%.
Oh, the dice got 50%. So, Steve, you're dice. Even with the dice.
Yeah.
Evan, yeah. Sorry.
Still beating chance.
I really don't even know what to say. Like, do I get, like, an award?
Don't say.
Or what's happening next?
You get nothing but pride.
You get two things.
What happens next is Randall tells me his guess for this one.
All right. Well, without the benefit of GWR, GWB, I'll do my best. I do like watching big cats on Animal Planet. The one about cheetahs being the oldest extant big cat, I guess that makes sense. Lion prides, they require a lot of food, and cheetahs are kind of solitary, so I can see them lasting longer. Cheetahs making several vocalizations, including a warning roar, and I've watched a lot of Animal Planet and Discovery and Nat Geo. I have never seen them roar. It's more like a chirp, from what I remember. So I'm a little suspicious of that one. A recent study using GPS shows that they run up to 58 miles an hour. That's about what I thought they ran. And the name cheetah comes from an Indian word meaning spotted one. I mean, cheetahs are from Africa. What are Indians doing? Are you talking about Native American or India Indian?
Yeah, India Indian, not American Indian.
India Indian. Okay, well, that makes more sense than Native Americans naming an African big cat. I'm going to have to go with cheetahs, the vocalization one being the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The 11 million years, that seems like a long time, but probably not for a genus. Not sure. Yeah, that's plausible, I guess. The tracking collars. Yeah, when I first saw 58, I mean, I've always thought that it was in the 60s, but I mean, you wouldn't make this fiction just for a few miles an hour. So that's, you know, close enough, I guess. And the cheetah one with the Indian word. I guess that's possible as well. They don't have to be endemic to the continent to name something. So that's fine. But yeah, the vocalizations, I can't ever remember hearing a cheetah making, much of a noise, especially one that would sound like a lion. It seems to me that they wouldn't even have the anatomy to pull off something like that. So I'm gonna go with the vocalizations as well.
Okay, Rebecca.
It just so happens that cheetahs were my favorite animal when I was like 10. So I know quite a bit about cheetahs. I did not know that their genus is the oldest. So I'm not sure about that one. I do think the Indian word meaning spotted one makes sense because Bob and Randall, I'll have you know that according to the encyclopedia I had when I was 10, cheetahs do, or at least did, exist in India. They spread from like well into the Middle East and Asia. So that makes sense. Their hunting speed of 58 miles per hour is only surprising in that I was always under the impression that it was 70 miles an hour at a top speed. But, of course, that's well inclusive of 58, so that's believable. Which leaves us with the warning roar thing. I could be wrong about this, and, you know, I haven't kept up to date on my cheetah facts. I no longer subscribe to Ranger Rick. so this could have changed, but I was under the impression that cheetahs are one of the only, if not the only, large cats who cannot roar. They can purr and make other interesting vocalizations, but I don't think that they can roar. So I'm going to GWR on this.
Woohoo!
And say that the roar thing is fiction.
All right, Jay.
Everybody covered it. I think it's crystal clear that the word cheetah, the name cheetah, comes from the Indian word meaning spotted one. It is the false, the fake.
Okay.
Okay.
And Evan.
Holy shit. Didn't see that coming.
I think I have a distinct advantage on this one because thanks to my daughter, I've seen all three Cheetah Girl movies.
Cheetah Girl.
What is that?
The Cheetah Girl.
That's with that Simon Ramon girl, right?
Cheetah Girl.
Oh, yeah, that's
oh,
right.
Oh, my God. Did I know that, Steve?
Raven,
edit that out.
Raven is one of them. Yeah.
Edit that out, Steve.
Bob, I caught you. Totally snagged you. I'm
gonna watch that.
Well, I will just get right to it like Jay did, except I'm not gonna say the spotted one. I think it's the vocalization ones as well, that one's gonna be the fiction.
You're gonna leave Jay hanging by himself, huh?
Sorry.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go through these. We'll start with number one. The cheetah genus, Acinonyx, is the oldest of the extant big cats, dating back about 11 million years. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Woo-hoo.
Yay. 11 million.
11 million years, yeah. So it took me a while to try to figure out like how far back they dated. I found lots of references. Definitely they are the oldest extant genus of big cats. That is crystal clear. But different references gave different dates for how far back the genus goes. And they branch off pretty far back from the other cats. So that, you know, in terms of the oldest common ancestor with the other big cats, they sort of branch off first. Yeah, there were lots of different species, and they ranged all over the place: North America, Asia, Europe, Africa. There was a giant cheetah that weighed, that's like twice as big as the modern cheetah. It weighed like 200 pounds.
Cool,
really big. Yeah, really big.
How fast
boy.
He could run?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the fastest cheetah is probably the current one. It's really fine tuned for speed.
Yeah, the arms race with its
prey. Yeah, they've sacrificed a lot. I mean, they're small. They're not as strong or as powerful as the other big cats. They really do rely heavily on their speed as their hunting strategy. And they often have kills taken away from them because they're just not big enough to defend them. So as soon as they kill a prey, they drag it under a tree to hide away so that they can eat it without being bothered.
And it's not just speed, Steve. I think there was a recent news item saying that their maneuverability is also another key aspect.
They maintain
raw speed.
They maintain their maneuverability even at their top hunting bursts of speed. Absolutely. Let's go on to number three. A recent study using GPS-enabled tracking collars clocked cheetah hunting speeds at up to 58 miles per hour or 93 kilometers per hour. You all also think this one is science, and this one is also science.
Yay. Hey.
So, yeah, that was
low, though. That's
it does
low.
Seem low.
Like 65.
So Rebecca's right. The most common reference you will find is to 70 miles per hour. People have claimed to have clocked cheetahs running at 70 miles per hour. But that's like, okay, it's about 300 yards from that tree to that tree and, you know, stopwatch it. But so we could assume maybe that the GPS tracking collars were more accurate than the previous clocking methods. So at their fastest burst of speed when hunting, the 58 miles per hour was the fastest any of the cheetahs were clocked. And it was a pretty
good
sample.
That pisses me off, actually.
Why? Because they're not as fast?
It's just not as impressive.
Well, myth busted.
Bob, this is how science works, though.
I know, but
they
science
could still
me off
run
sometimes.
You down and kill you. Very
I know.
they measured 367 predominantly hunting runs of five wild cheetahs.
Oh my God! So that's solid. That's solid. Then 58 is like that's it. They're not breaking 60. Ugh.
That's not true. I mean, because it depends on their prey and how fast they have to go. They're not going to be like, okay, guys, this is for the record.
No, but you would think after 300 runs.
We're on the clock now.
You'd get a bunch over 60, you would think. But
maybe the collars slow them down.
Weight them down, yeah.
Maybe.
Let's go back to number two.
In fact, they could test this by rigging up something like what they do at greyhound racing parks. You know, like a
little bunny
motorized
rabbit.
Prey that they can drive at 70 miles an hour and see if any of the cheetahs can catch it. Yeah, then you would see what their actual top speed is.
Yeah. Oh, wait. What about a radar gun? I mean, I just assume that's what they probably would have used. And they're cheap enough.
But they're inconsistent depending on which radar gun you use.
And if there are several cheetahs
running near each other, it could screw it up.
God, Bob, you can't deny the GPS, man.
All right, what are we doing here?
Let's keep going. I know, I'm not.
All right, science, number two. Science is a cheetahs cold make mistress. Several vocalizations, including a warning roar that is often mistaken for that of a lion, which they use to scare larger predators from their kills. Uh-huh. Everyone but Jay thinks this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction.
Yay. Oh, I'm back to 50%.
Good job, everyone.
Good job, Evan.
I'm retiring, batting 1,000.
Well done, yep. Randall.
Randall, 100%.
Randall.
Wait, that means I've pulled ahead of Jay. That's the most important thing that's happened just now.
So, yeah, but cheetahs do make several different vocalizations, but they are the one big cat that does not roar. They absolutely do not roar. They do make chirping noises, purring, and a variety, several other noises.
And other big cats can't purr. They can only roar.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
cat facts.
Which brings us to number four. The name cheetah comes from the Indian word meaning spotted one. And that one, of course, is science. Of course, the word, there is no literal translation for the word. So if you look up the etymology of cheetah, you'll get variations on spotted one. One reference I read just said spots or distinctively marked, many colored, variegated, you know, spotted, speckled. You know, whatever. You have to translate it somehow, but it basically means spotted one. The word cheetah, C-H-I-T-A.
I was totally okay with this as a theme. Let's stick to animals Rebecca loved when she was 10.
I'll take animals Rebecca likes for 1,000.
So, Jay, why did you GWR, man? Are you an anti-Deptite?
You got to understand something.
You're
for the first
anti-Deptite.
Time, someone could appropriately say, I'm going to GWJ. I wasn't going to, like, I had
that
a, I'm,
would never
I'm
be
in the lead, you know, I had to live that role for the brief moment that it lasted.
Is that what just happened? Success went to your head and you immediately lost. Yes.
So you're basically saying that you choked, Jay.
Are you surprised, Rebecca? I brazenly picked number four, where everyone else dared to tread. I went there.
Yeah, you choked. Yeah. All right. But good job, Randall, on your first. And you headed the lineup. You had no help on this one. Good job. Jay, but you get your weekly consolation prize of getting to read the quote.
A listener named Stuart Kurgian from New Jersey sent in a quote. He said, this quote is from Arthur Eddington. Anybody know who Arthur Eddington is?
Is that from True Blood?
No, Eddington was the astronomer.
That's Edgington.
You're right, Evan. Evan.
The eclipse.
You got
it. He photographed the eclipse that Einstein used to verify his
theory of relativity.
His theories.
Exactly.
Yes, theory of
good job, Evan. He was a professor of astronomy at the University of Cambridge. He was arguably the most important astrophysicist of the early 20th century. Friend of Einstein, and I have a quote that that Stewart sent in, and it's from the HBO special about Einstein and Arthur Eddington, and we're not 100% sure if where the quote comes from, but I searched and I searched online, and I'm only finding this one source, but if anyone has a correction, send it in. But it's a great quote, so that's why I decided to use it. The pursuit of truth in science transcends national boundaries. It takes us beyond hatred and anger and fear. It is the best of us. Arthur Eddington!
So this is our last show before we will be at the amazing meeting. We'll be at TAM 2013 next week, July 11th through 14th. There are two SGU events I want to remind our listeners about who are going to TAM. You have to sign up for separately. The SGU dinner is Friday night. We'll have several hours to just sit and chat with our listeners. And we're going to be doing an auction during the SGU dinner, including auctioning off a coveted guest rogue spot. And we're going to also be doing a skeptical quiz show with our listeners playing. And the winner of the quiz show will get a free VIP access to TAM 2014. And that's a $1,000 value. We also have Saturday night, the SGU poker tournament. There are still a few seats left for that, so sign up. You can sign up for these two events through the website, or you could sign up for them at the event. So when you arrive at TAM and you register, just sign up for the SU dinner or the SU poker tournament at that time. All right, guys. Well, Randall, thanks for joining us this week. We had a lot of fun with you this week on the show.
Thanks, man.
It's been a pleasure, and I checked something off my bucket list. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Yeah, thanks, Randall. It was fun.
You could die in peace.
Thank you.
And thanks to the rest of you for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
Harry Potter, sir.
That's Harry Potter, it is.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.